Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, August 28, 2017. A U.S. journalist is killed in a battle between government forces and rebels.
He was with us in the front line, but he was only photographing. So when we reached toward the end of Kaya, bordering Uganda, the government forces spotted Chris. Together with our bodyguard, fired straight at him, and they hit him on the head.
And government spokesman says the young American journalist was on a different mission in South Sudan.
He is not a freelance journalist, he is a rebel. So far, he attacked the town together with the rebels, and he was killed in the line of the rebels. He is not a freelance journalist, we don't know that, because when he was killed, there was no any identification to show that he was enemy.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A young American freelance journalist was killed by South Sudan government forces while embedded with rebels in Kaya along the South Sudan-Uganda border. Christopher Allen was fatally shot during a battle between government forces and rebels loyal to former first Vice President Riek Machar on Saturday. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
The rebels say they granted Allen's request to document the South Sudan war and its effect on civilians. SPLIO Deputy Military Spokesman Lam Paul Gabriel says Allen spent nearly 2 weeks with the rebels before being killed Saturday while taking pictures of a battle between government and the rebel forces near the South Sudan-Uganda crossing point.
He was with us in the front line, but he was only photographing. So when we reached toward the end of Kaya, bordering Uganda, they spotted Chris, the government forces spotted Chris. Together with our bodyguard. So they fired straight at him and they hit him on the head.
Gabriel says they tried to retrieve his body, but it was difficult during heavy fighting. He says the rebels lost two people trying to do it, but managed to get hold of Allen's camera and notebooks. South Sudan Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Santo Domich says government forces killed 16 rebels in Kaya and grouped Allen into that number.
On the ground, about 16 have been found around the defensive position of the SPLA, including this white man. So 15 are indigenous from South Sudan, and one is a white man.
South Sudan government forces flee the body of the slain journalist to the capital Juba in a military helicopter on Saturday. Allen's body, as seen by reporters when it arrived at Juba International Airport, was dressed in civilian clothes with a white red ribbon tied on the upper part of his left arm. Colonel Domich says the red ribbon is similar to what was found on the bodies of slain rebel fighters. But Colonel Gabriel says the red ribbon is used to identify fighters and civilians, including journalists in the territories controlled by the rebels.
The red tag is just to identify us from our opponent. For us, we tied it on our head, but for him, let him put it on his left shoulder to make sure we know he's with us, because we don't know, maybe government also will have their own journalists, so in case when we're evacuating, we know he's with us.
Gabriel also denies government forces killed 15 rebel fighters.
We lost two people in Kaya, but three we lost in Kimba, but we killed a number of government soldiers, more than 40. In Kaya only, we killed 43.
An eyewitness who spoke on condition of anonymity out of concern for his safety says the few civilians who were in the area when the fighting broke out over the weekend have since fled to neighboring Uganda. Domich says government forces are now in full control of the Kaya border crossing point.
The SPLA is controlling the situation, and fortunately, in this attack, there has never been a report of civilian being harmed or maybe properties being looted by rebels.
Gabriel insists his group controls most of Kaya.
3/4 of Kaya is in our hands. The government is just at the border, the checkpoint where there's a big mango tree. I don't know if it's a mango tree or something, but they are there confined in that place. They cannot move out of there towards inside Kaya. They can only go to Uganda side. Just because they are taking cover of the buildings and also the Kaya stream itself.
The U.S. State Department issued a statement confirming that Allen is a U.S. freelance journalist. South Sudan Army spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kong says no one has claimed Allen's body at the military hospital mortuary. The United Nations mission in South Sudan expressed its severe sympathy to the family and friends of Christopher Allen in a statement today. UNMISS spokesman Daniel Dixon.
UNMISS has repeatedly stated that any attacks on journalists are unacceptable, and it calls on all parties to the ongoing conflict in South Sudan to respect the freedom of the press.
Allen's death brings to 10 the number of journalists that have been killed in South Sudan since 2012. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The Committee for the Protection of Journalists has condemned the killing of Christopher Allen. Angela Quintal is the Africa Program Coordinator for CPJ. We now go live to Angela in New York to learn more about the work of Christopher Allen. Angela, are you there?
I am indeed. Good day to you and to your listeners.
Yeah, tell us more about Christopher Allen. What do you know about him?
Look, we know that Christopher is a freelance journalist that has done work for many publications. Most recently, obviously, he was in South Sudan. He did work for Vice, for Independent in the UK, and other outlets.
And what kind of a journalist is he? Because covering a battleground is not easy.
Definitely, it's not easy, and it's particularly not very easy in South Sudan, as you know. Local journalists themselves, many have had to flee for their own safety. Foreign journalists who have tried to work in South Sudan have not necessarily been given permission to operate there. So in terms of a climate of censorship, it is a huge problem. So given what we are seeing in terms of the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, what others, including the United Kingdom, have even suggested that there's a genocide that is going on, it's incredibly difficult for journalists, both local and foreign journalists, to operate in an environment where they're able to do their work freely and certainly in safety.
And tell us a little bit more about your engagement with authorities in South Sudan, because all they are saying is that journalists are free to do their job in South Sudan. There is no censorship. What do they tell you?
Well, it's a matter of trying to get the authorities in South Sudan to actually speak to the Committee to Protect Journalists. So what we have found is that there isn't certainly wanting to engage with the authorities from our side is something that we would welcome. That's not necessarily something that the authorities would like to do, I would say. So it is quite difficult. We do what we can, and we operate through various channels. But at the end of the day, I think it is important for the international community as well to ensure that journalists who are operating there are given the safety that they deserve, because you know, we do need the sort of information that is important for people to make those decisions, to make those choices, to understand what is going on. It is an incredibly complex situation. And so the more information that there is, the better for everybody.
And what are the few journalists who are still working in South Sudan telling you about their story, about what they go through on a daily basis?
It's awful, frankly. I mean, these are journalists that are professionals who are trying to do their work, and I'm just trying to ensure that the information that they get can be broadcast, can be put out there, but they are facing increasing pressure. I mean, so there's not only attempts to censor, but I mean, in terms of the danger to their own lives, to their families' lives, and that's why I've said that several of the local journalists have actually had to flee. As you've seen with the displacements, and it's not only journalists, many, many, many people from South Sudan have actually fled into neighboring Uganda. The humanitarian crisis is huge, and journalists are among those who have had to flee and are effectively in limbo in countries, in bordering countries. You'll find them in Uganda, you'll find them in Kenya. They are leading lives of abject misery, and they're not able to do their jobs simply because they're effectively refugees in limbo in a country, knowing that what is going on in their own country is a disaster, and that people are suffering hugely.
And Human Rights Watch published a report today saying that Christopher Allen is journalist number 10 who has been killed on the line of duty in South Sudan. With this happening, is there anything the international community should do regarding the death of Chris and other journalists who are working under very difficult conditions in South Sudan?
Definitely. I think the problem that you see in South Sudan and elsewhere in the world when journalists are killed is the level of impunity, that there doesn't appear to be any consequences. And therefore, one journalist who is killed, today, it's another journalist tomorrow, and yet we do not see the perpetrators of these attacks or killings being brought to book. And I think it is important to ensure that does become an issue and that does become an international call. Sure, in terms of the security of journalists, and I must say the United Nations and others have put that high on the agenda and that it is important, but I think it's a matter of governments themselves and parties who are part of conflict to understand that at the end of the day, a journalist is not an enemy. A journalist is there to do their job and to ensure that the world is aware of what is going on in a particular situation. And therefore, it really is important for journalists not to be seen as being soft targets. And I'm afraid this is what appears to have occurred in South Sudan, correctly so in terms of our own information, in terms of killings of journalists there since South Sudan became the world's newest nation in 2011. Our 2016 census, I think we do have 10 journalists who have been killed. Of these, 5 have been confirmed. The motive for the killings have been confirmed. The others not confirmed, but certainly, yes, a total of 10 journalists since 2011.
Angela, thank you very much for speaking to us about the situation of journalists in South Sudan. That's Angela Quintal, the Africa Program Coordinator for CPJ, live from New York. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui adamantly denies Christopher Allen was a journalist. He tells VOA's James Batty he was considered a rebel by government forces because he carried no identity as a journalist.
What happened yesterday morning, a group of rebels attacked Kaya military garrison. In the attack, a fight ensued, and in the fighting, 16 rebels, including a white rebel, were killed. The identity of that white man is not known, but he was among those who attacked the garrison. He was at his full gear fighting in line with his colleagues, the rebels.
Mr. Minister, according to the story I'm reading on from the wires, this Mr. Christopher Allen was a freelance journalist. Why do you call him a white rebel?
He is not a freelance journalist, he is a rebel. So far, he attacked the town together with the rebels and he was killed in the line of the rebels. He is not a freelance journalist, we don't know that, because when he was killed, there was no any identification to show that he was anything. That is one. Number two, we have no such a person who entered, such a journalist who entered South Sudan and was allowed to go to whatever area. So this man, we don't know his identity. If the Americans are saying that he's an American, then they know how he entered. But he did not enter through our official entry routes. He came, attacked with the rebels and was killed. This is why we say he's a rebel.
So your government has no information of Mr. Allen entering your country?
He has not entered our country.
So, I mean, you said there was no identity on him, but did you make any effort to... So where is his body?
His body is now in Juba Military Hospital, here in Juba.
Has your government contacted the U.S. Embassy?
We are not ready to contact the U.S. Embassy because there is nothing which indicates that he is an American. It is anybody who believes that that person is, you should go to the mortuary and identify the person, not us.
So you call him a white rebel. I'm wondering whether your government or military have past experiences with so-called white rebels fighting on the side of the anti-government forces.
Listen, please. We are not in a position to identify that person. So you should not expect us to contact any embassy and tell them that this is your man. It is that embassy which believes that they have lost a journalist who entered South Sudan through other illegal means and died, that can go and look for that person, not us. So anyway, I call upon those who are claiming that person who died in the lines of the rebels. If there are anybody who is claiming that person should come forward and tell us as to how their citizen entered South Sudan and be on the side of the rebels, fighting against South Sudan government.
Are you making that call to the U.S. Embassy?
If they are the ones who have confirmed it, then they should tell us how did their citizen enter South Sudan fighting side by side with the rebels.
Minister, I thank you very much again. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, that was South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei speaking to VOA's James Batty earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, refugee parents in Uganda start their own school to educate their children. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think that it's okay for people under age 16 to get married?
It is not okay because they are not emotionally mature. They are not matured enough to be wives. The essence of marriage is not just getting married, but being a wife. Maybe 21, 20, yes.
It's not okay to be married because they are still children or it's still a child. We know that a child is someone who is below 18 years. And when you are below 18 years, you are still under the care of parents.
Physically, they are not matured. Mentally, they are not. Emotionally and psychologically, they are not. There's more to getting married than just being together. There are so many things they will have to handle, which I'm sure at that age, they can't handle a lot of that pressure.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The influx of South Sudanese refugees into Uganda has overwhelmed the already congested learning facilities inside the camps, forcing parents to look for alternatives. As Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Adjumani, parents in Pagirinya camp have been able to mobilize unemployed teachers and establish a school of their own.
Parents and teachers named the school Tandala, which in the local Madi language means in the open air, referring to the school's humble beginnings under trees. The school stands on a 200 by 150 meters piece of land that was donated by the Ugandan host community late last year. Head teacher Alera William says the initiative came about because of the extreme overcrowding in camp schools, causing many children to stay at home.
And it gave us pity, so we say, no, these are our children, we need to settle them. We need to open school so that they come to get knowledge, so that when they go back to Sudan, they'll be the one to hold the country.
William says in its first year, the school enrolled more than 1,000 students. As it moves into its second year, the student population has increased to 1,039. Unlike most South Sudanese schools, nearly half of the student population is girls. Nancy Drani, a primary 7 pupil, says she enrolled at Tandala because of the overcrowding at both UNHCR-supported schools in the Pagirinya camp.
The other schools, like Pagirinya 2 primary school, there are many children in that school. You can see sometimes a week you can continue moving there, but there is no another thing that you can understand well.
The two-room mat structure has iron sheets for roofing donated by Korean missionaries working for the Catholic Relief Agency Caritas. It houses primary 6 and 7 pupils. William says most of the lower classes are held under trees in the school compound.
We have P1, P2, P5. These are all learning under trees. Actually, even P3 and P4, when the temperature is hot, they are coming out because the tent there is very small, and because of high temperature, they are unable to receive lesson properly.
Tandala Primary School has no desks. Most children sit on stones. Aside from the Korean missionaries' donation, South Sudanese help if they can. 15-year-old Primary 7 student Rubano Steven says when he decided to enroll, his main concern was where he was going to sit.
I thought that I would sit on the stone, but good enough the teachers told us to come with our chairs so that we can sit on them.
Steven does not regret joining the school, saying he is happy with the Tandala teachers. He says his parents must contribute only 5,000 Ugandan shillings, about $1.5 per term, for the PTF fee. Duku George Miller, chairperson of the school's Parent Teachers Association, says the money is used to buy chalk, teaching materials, and stationery. Parents, he says, also contribute in other important ways.
We normally only contribute with the parents, like a voluntary work, digging latrine for these children. And some of the classrooms where we are actually calling parents to at least do some work, like bush clearing, so that these children can learn better.
Mandera Jocelyn, the school's senior girls teacher, says most pupils do well except the girls, who miss several days of school each month when they have their periods.
These girls usually miss school during their period because they have nothing to help them to support in that area. So they remain at home when they are in their period.
Nevertheless, Jocelyn says the girls are eager to learn.
They are coming up. They are interested in learning. Since they came from there also when they were in class, they were just not from home. These children were in class when they were broke in our country.
Mila, whose children are also enrolled in Tandala, says he is satisfied with the school's quality of education.
I can see my child, when any child go home, the child will go with a good knowledge. And when you check the book, the books are also really good. And there is something written. So you can see there is a marking.
Tandala Primary boasts of having 27 teachers, including a dozen women, who all work on a voluntary basis. Primary 7 has 53 pupils, the smallest number of students in a class at the school. Primary 4 has the most, with 171 children. William says this is still less than half the size of the smallest class at the other refugee schools in Adzumani district. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Adzumani.
Kenya's Supreme Court has granted the opposition access to all official telephones and the Electoral Commission's computer servers. As official hearing opened today on the opposition's challenge to presidential poll results. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Following pretrial discussions over the weekend, the Supreme Court has begun hearing arguments on the opposition party's petition contesting results of the August 8th presidential election. The official results showed President Uhuru Kenyatta defeating Raila Odinga by about 1.4 million votes. Since Election Day, the National Super Alliance, or NASA, opposition coalition has argued that the voting system was hacked, leading to what they call a stolen election. The Supreme Court's first order of business Monday was the opposition's request for access to the Electoral Commission's servers, which NASA says will provide the necessary evidence to support their argument.
It is our order that the petitioners, as well as the third respondents, shall be granted a read-only access, which includes copying, if necessary, of the following information.
Some of the information that Justice Isaac Lena Ola listed included firewalls, password policy, system user types and levels of access, and GPS locations from each electoral kit. Lena Ola also said the parties would be given access to the official tally forms from the polling stations and constituencies. The court registrar will supervise these exercises, in which each party is permitted two agents to observe. Three court-appointed information and communication technology, or ICT, experts will also be present. A report about these exercises is due by 5 p.m. local time on Tuesday. The rest of Monday's hearing was scheduled for Odinga and Kenyatta's lawyers to argue their sides of the case, as well as the Electoral Commission to defend the integrity of its voting systems. The Supreme Court has until Friday to give its final ruling. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Cameroon, where fall armyworm has spread to Cameroon. The pest has attacked crops in at least 24 African countries, including South Sudan. In Cameroon, the Minister of Agriculture says it is particularly concerned about the impact of the fall armyworm in north and eastern part of the country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story for VOA from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development Minister Delegate Ananga Messina says fall armyworm has infested 6 of the Central African state's 10 regions.
Nous faisons face à une réelle menace.
She says the armyworms have been a serious threat to food security in Cameroon because cereals like maize, sorghum, rice and legume plants like cowpea, peanuts and beans are increasingly being attacked every day. She says the situation is particularly worrisome on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, where the population and 100,000 Nigerian refugees are already suffering from food scarcity due to the Boko Haram conflict. Messina told VOA about half of Cameroon's 23 million inhabitants and millions of livestock risk hunger in the months ahead. She said the armyworms have extended to Cameroon's eastern border, putting neighboring Central African Republic at risk, a country gripped by a severe humanitarian crisis after years of conflict. Cameroon has launched a task force to manage the infestation. Some farmers have been using chemicals to kill the pest, but agriculture technician Anised Vondo says that is not the best approach.
The problem is that the insecticide is not good for the health of the farmer. It's not good for the environment. It kills also other organisms in the environment. Using insecticide is not the good way. You should try to look for other solution, because this insect in the field is also eaten by other organisms.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization reports fall armyworm was first detected in 4 countries in West Africa in early 2016. It has since spread to at least 20 other countries. Experts say the fall armyworms can reproduce rapidly and can fly long distances in moth form, though it remains unknown how the pest spread to West Africa from South America. The FAO is leading the regional response efforts in Africa, and it says it is drawing from lessons learned in the Americas on sustainable fall armyworm management. FAO Sub-Regional Coordinator for Southern Africa, David Peary, says methods like regular monitoring and hand-picking of worm larvae can be effective.
For armyworm has a lot of natural enemies, and we should enhance their use to control the for armyworm. So the key message is for armyworm has come here to stay, and also that use of chemical pesticides should be reduced to a minimum.
Staple crops like maize, sorghum, rice and sugarcane have been hit hard in Africa, though the fall armyworm can ravage more than 80 other plant species. Losses for Africa are estimated at least $13 billion. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We would like to hear more. We would like to know your take about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com, or you can also check us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. See you here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Thank you.
bidam wa haya falin.